Time we started out by reading the verse where the glory of the Lord fills the tabernacle. So it's in Exodus 40. I'm just going to read it again here to get us started out. Exodus 40, beginning at verse 34. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled on it. And the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Throughout all their journeys, whenever the cloud was taken up from over the tabernacle, the people of Israel would set out. But if the cloud was not taken up, then they did not set out till the day that it was taken up. For the cloud of the Lord was on the tabernacle by day, and fire was in it by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel throughout all their journeys. So, let's just kind of open the floor up here and see what you guys remember from last week. Anybody? Yep. We got a couple of faces that were here, though. Okay. Well, for the most part, we kind of started out and we talked a little bit. Well, 2 weeks ago, we talked about creation and fall, and we talked about how God dwelt with his people in the Garden of Eden. And yet, that fellowship that God had with them in Eden was broken through the fall. And so something has to be made right. That fall, that brokenness, that rebellion, that sin has to be made right in order for God to dwell amongst his people. But we also talked about how you can't go back to the Eden state. The only way to go through it is to go forward. And so as we march forward, the next place that we find God then really dwelling with his people in a new way is with the tabernacle. So we talked a little bit about the tabernacle as far as the structures itself, you know, what's there, the furniture, how it's set up. We highlighted that the most holy place is a perfect cube, just kind of in passing. There's significance to it, but we'll come back to it later. Let's see here. We talked a little bit about Moses in the wilderness. No one can see God and live. So I think that probably summarizes enough for us to kind of start moving forward here. So, does anybody remember what furnishings were in the tabernacle? Does anyone remember what pieces of furniture we have in the tabernacle? Okay, there's a couple of altars. Yep, there's a lampstand, very good. The mercy seat, it's part of the Ark of the Covenant, yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's got the two cherubim on it, and it's basically the top of the Ark. Okay, yep. Yeah, well, the table of the bread of the presence, yeah. There's a wash basin, yep, in the courtyard. Yeah, very good. I'm pretty impressed. If we start looking through this, we've kind of got all of these things in the tabernacle, and one thing that's important to see is that they're all there for a purpose. And so some of them we get very explicit purposes. The altar of incense is to burn incense in part to cover the smell of the sacrifices. Or the bronze altar is there to facilitate the burning of the sacrifices. The Ark of the Covenant is there as, I think the picture is the footstool of God's throne. You get that kind of explicitly in the Psalms a little bit later on. So, we talked a little bit about this last week, but since we've got so many new faces, why do we have the tabernacle as the tent of meeting? So why is it that God inhabits a tent?
Mobile.
Okay. Yes. So So because it's a tent, because Israelite, or, I mean, the name of the book is Exodus, right? So the people are on the move. And so God puts a structure in place where he's moving with the people, and not only moving with, but actually leading the people. And so that those cloud, the cloud and the fire that we saw in that Exodus 40 passage, we also see in all of the passages where the Israelites are moving out, and God leads them in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. So, as we move forward through the Bible storyline, we have the Exodus and God dwelling with his people there. But eventually we get to the conquest, and we have the Holy Land, and God's people move into a more permanent dwelling place. And so God then initiates the building of a temple, the building of a house in some sense. I don't want to read the passage because we're going to, I think we'll get sidetracked if we do, but... in the passage, David talks about, it's kind of the beginning of the Davidic covenant that we talk about a little bit with Jesus. And so Jesus is kind of the greater David. But David wants to build God a house. And God, in part because David initiates, I think, and in part because of who David is, in part because of a whole bunch of things, you get God, the prophet basically tells David, go ahead, do what you're going to do. And then God stops the prophet before he's even made it out of the castle, out of the palace, and tells him to go back and say, no, are you the person to build me a house? And so you're told then that David's son will build the house for God. And so we get the Solomonic temple. So one of the things that we want to talk about a little bit is what changes between the tabernacle and the Solomonic temple, the first temple. So if we look at 2 Chronicles chapter 7, verses 1 to 3. Somebody like to read that for us? 2 Chronicles 7, verses 1 through 3. Thank you. So what we're seeing here is the same thing that we just saw in Exodus 40, right? Where we're seeing the fire coming down from heaven and filling the temple. Again, kind of the sign that God is dwelling in that place. God is dwelling in that temple in a special way. But there are a whole bunch of things that go into God dwelling, God choosing that place. So the tabernacle, it's temporary, it moves. It's not locked into a specific location. But the temple is. The temple's built in Jerusalem. It's there, it's permanent. It's built in as a structure that cannot be moved. You know, massive stone... massive stone structure with all of the gilding and the special huge versions of a lot of the furniture that you see in the tabernacle model here. So one of the things that takes place And I think this helps explain a lot of the Old Testament issues, I guess, is what's called the law of centralization. So if you'll turn to Deuteronomy 12, this is a bit of a longer passage, but I think it's worthwhile to go through it. So would somebody like to read, let's say, 12, 1 through 7?
Meredith?
Thank you. So, what do we see in this, or what is this verse talking about? Like, if you're trying to summarize the main topic in a word. Instructions for what?
Worship.
Instructions for worship. Very good. So, we're talking about instructions for worship here. You're not to do as the people who were here before you. They worshiped their gods in all of these high places and the groves and all over the land. But the Lord God is not to be worshiped in that way. Instead, the Lord God chooses a place where he will be worshiped. And everything that is to do with that worship must take place there. And so when you read through the Old Testament, one of the things that you see, particularly in Kings and Chronicles, is you get this slow, steady march through. This king was a good king or a bad king. He did this or he did that, but he was a bad king. He didn't tear down the high places that his fathers had put there. He didn't do all of these things that were violating this law. It's this law about the worship of God, where you have the temple itself that is the central point of all of the worship of God. Does that make sense? Do we have any questions? Okay. Specifically, no. But it means that that worship in the form of sacrifice and in the form of the feasts really should be centered around the temple. Yep.
We weren't allowed to take those things specifically prescribed by God.
Yep.
In a specific place and decide for yourself you were going to change that or alter that or move that to some other place that you weren't choosing. In the wilderness, the elements, the furniture, everything in it was by his command.
Nadab and Abihu.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and even they offered strange fire, God consumes them on the spot, and the other priests are not even allowed to grieve.
Yeah, that's right.
Were you going to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say, it appears to be very regimented.
Mm-hmm.
God's place, God moves, people move.
Yeah.
Methods of worship, all the religious teeth.
Yeah. Yeah, I think any of us would. I mean, even and I guess one thing that I didn't highlight this last week, but one of the things that you notice is that you have the tabernacle when they set up camp, so they're going to stay here for a little bit. They set up the tabernacle in the middle, and then they set up the different tribes all the way around, and it's very structured, very regimented, militaristic. So it looks like basically a military encampment. So even all the way through Exodus, before you get to the conquest, you're getting this messaging that tells us this is God's holy people, it's God's holy army, and they will have to use military, or they will be used as a military in the conquest of the Holy Land. They will drive the people out before them. So, with Solomonic Temple, God chooses Jerusalem. And all worship then is supposed to go through Jerusalem. Later on, right after Solomon, you have the end of the United Monarchy. So, no longer do you have all 12 tribes recognizing one king, recognizing the Davidic king. Instead, you have two tribes that have formed the nation of Judah, and the other 10 tribes now are the nation of Israel. Or Ephraim, depending on where you're reading. But the 10 tribes don't recognize, because Jerusalem is in Judah, so they don't recognize Judah. And one of the reasons then that you get the northern tribes driven out and never to come back is because of not worshiping God in the right way. It's because of idolatry. It's because of not following God's prescriptions, not recognizing where God has commanded them that they are to worship him. They actually go so far as to build their own temple. So, I guess we may as well go ahead and read through the rest of this little law of centralization passage. It's, like I said, it's a little bit lengthy, so please bear with me. But would somebody like to read verses 8 to 14? Still in Deuteronomy 12. Jim?
Have not as yet come to the rest, to the inheritance that the Lord your God is giving you. But when you go over the Jordan and live in the land that the Lord your God is giving you to inherit, and when he gives you rest from your enemies around, so that you live in safety, then to the place that the Lord your God will choose to make his name dwell there. There you shall bring all that I command you, your burnt offering, and your sacrifices, your tithes and your contributions that you present, and all your finest vow offerings that you vow to the Lord. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your sons and your daughters, your male servants and your female servants, and the Levite that is within your towns, since he has no portion or inheritance with you. Take care that you do not offer your burnt offerings at any place that you see, but at the place that the Lord will choose in one of your tribes. There you shall offer your burnt offerings, and there
Thank you. So again, we see a lot of repetition in that first chunk into the second chunk. I think a lot of us in today's day and age miss this, but do you have any idea why we might see the kind of repetition that we do in some of these passages? Have you thought about it? Okay. Yeah, you don't have bold and italics and underlines in your text at this point. What you have is repetition. And so if you really want to hammer something home, you say it 2, 3, 4 times. And so as we keep kind of marching through this, there's 2 more sections that we'll look at. And you'll notice that so much of the themes of these really are, you will not do like the people that you're driving out. You will do as the Lord has commanded and come to this central location for the Lord's worship, and particularly for sacrifice. Would somebody like to read verses 15 to 19? Kathy? You can keep going to 19, please. Yep. Thank you. And so again, we see you can, how far in this do I want to go? So you can sack, or you can slaughter animals to eat them. You can do all of this stuff, but you can't, particularly the grain tithes and some of the offering tithes are then used for feasts. And so those feasts happen in Jerusalem. They happen surrounding the temple. You're not free to eat of those in wherever you choose. I guess I'll just read this last little chunk here, and we'll move on from here. When the Lord your God enlarges your territory as he has promised you, and you say, I will eat meat because you crave meat, you may eat meat whenever you desire. If the place that the Lord your God will choose to put his name there is too far from you, then you may kill any of your herds or your flocks which the Lord has given you, as I have commanded you, and you may eat within your towns whenever you desire. Just as the gazelle or the deer is eaten, so you may eat of it. The unclean and the clean alike may eat of it. Only be sure that you do not eat the blood, for the blood is the life, and you shall not eat the life with the flesh. You shall not eat it, you shall not pour it out on the earth like water. You shall not eat it that all may go well with you and with your children after you, when you do what is right in the sight of the Lord. But the holy things that are due from you, and your vow offerings you shall take, and you shall go to the place that the Lord will choose, and offer your burnt offerings, the flesh and the blood, on the altar of the Lord your God. The blood of your sacrifices shall be poured out on the altar of the Lord your God, but the flesh you may eat. Be careful to obey all these words that I command you, that it may go well with you and with your children after you forever, when you do what is good and right in the sight of the Lord your God. So again, you want to eat meat, but you're not to eat 2 things. One, you're not to eat the blood. 2, the stuff that is to be sacrificed, the stuff that belongs to God. So the firstborn of animals, the best tenth of grain and the produce and that kind of stuff belongs to God. And so that stuff then is to go to Jerusalem and to be sacrificed appropriately, not wherever you would choose to do so. the life being in the blood is actually a really interesting theme here too. We're not going to touch on it very much here just because it's going to distract us a little bit. So, now that we've talked through law of centralization, we've looked a little bit at the first temple. Do you see any differences between the first temple and the tabernacle other than that it's fixed in location? Not from what we read. The short answer is that there's just not a whole lot. There's some differences in that the temple, as it's built, is not as strongly described. You don't get the same level of detail for prescriptions for the temple that you do for the tabernacle. You get a lot of description of what it looks like as they've built it, but not how they will build it. It doesn't seem like there's very much difference really between the two beyond the location and the lack of prescription for all of the things inside of it. Yep. A little bit. I'm going to kind of breeze through it a little bit too. Absolutely. So with the first temple comes to an end when it's destroyed in the fall of Jerusalem. We find it in particularly Ezekiel and Jeremiah. For some background here. So the northern kingdom is conquered by Assyria. They're taken off. They'll never come back. The southern kingdom then, Babylon, eventually comes and basically dominates Assyria. And so then Babylon then is the main, I guess, foil that God uses in his dealings with Judah. Babylon comes in and conquers, well, it comes in, has a couple of raiding parties with Judah, takes off some parts or some people, some exiles from Judah early. That's where Ezekiel comes out. And then eventually comes back and crushes Jerusalem, conquers Jerusalem, demolishes the temple. There's nothing left. Hauls all the people, or at least all of the people of note, off back to Babylon, scatters them around. There's two things, I guess, that I want to highlight there. The first is that the people no longer have a home to go home to, the people who are exiled. And the second thing that I want to highlight there is that there no longer is this mediating structure, this place where God meets with his people. It's just not there. And so I want to talk about this one little kind of interesting interlude. So if you would turn to Ezekiel 1. This is not a book we deal a whole lot with, I think, but... And would somebody like to read Ezekiel 1, verses 1 to, say 1 to 4? Meredith?
Now it came to pass in the 13th year, in the 4th month, in the 5th day of the month, as I was among the captives at the river of
Kabar. Jehoiakim. Thank you. And so as we continue going through Ezekiel 1, just for brevity's sake here, what we get is this description of a temple-like structure. It's something that is God is meeting with Ezekiel by the river Kabar. And so we've talked about the temple and how God is located in this one specific place. And yet, here he is, in this mobile temple type structure, meeting with Ezekiel in Babylon. The temple's still in place in Jerusalem at this point. It hasn't been torn down yet. And yet we see God meeting in a special way with Ezekiel outside of that temple structure. And so if we turn to Ezekiel 10... we see that same mobile temple structure. So in Ezekiel 10, I guess the place to read, of course I didn't actually write down verses. Let me summarize. So Ezekiel 10, we get this mobile throne chariot that's described in really symbolic language that tells us a lot about who God is. It tells us, you know, so we get symbols that talk about the omniscience of God, and we get symbols that talk about the omnipresence of God, and so on and so forth. We also see God showing Ezekiel the temple. And he's showing Ezekiel all of these terrible things that are being done in the temple. Idol worship that's happening in the temple. Not just the Israelites are engaged in it, but actually within the temple walls themselves, the priests are engaging in worshiping other gods. And so eventually you see God then in his mobile throne chariot leaves the temple. He's no longer in that structure. He then goes to the neighboring mountaintop. And the message there, in part, is that God's people have turned against him, and so God has given them over to it. Babylon will conquer, but they will conquer because God has left. God has ordained that Babylon will conquer. It's judgment. And yet God is still dwelling with his exiled people. And as we move forward in Ezekiel, one of the things that you see is that you do start getting these promises of hope as we go toward the end, and you get this eschatological temple, this end times, this last things temple, that we're going to save for much later. But we will work through it a little bit. But there's also this secondary fulfillment where we do get this promise that God will bring the southern kingdom. He will bring the faithful Israelites back out of captivity. He will bring them home. And there will be a new temple where God mediates, or God's presence is mediated to his people. And so we do get the second temple built by Nehemiah. And this is kind of me glossing over this a little bit. The one thing that I really want to highlight about the second temple is that, you know how we've read those passages where God's presence inhabits the tabernacle, God's presence inhabits the first temple? There's not one for the second. There is no passage in Scripture where we get a story or a scene like that with the second temple. So we've kind of, this is kind of our gloss through all of the tabernacle and the temple as a concrete physical meeting place with God and his people. Now, if you remember back last week, we talked a little bit about how Eden almost functions as a temple or a tabernacle because God dwells with his people there. But so I guess one thing I want to highlight here is what differences do you see between Eden and between these later structures? There's one in particular that everything flows out of. Yep. Yeah, very much so. And so what changed? Yeah. And so now, because again, you can't go back. And so you have these mediating structures in place, and yet things aren't the same. Because you still have sin and you still have death. Matthew 18, I believe. Yeah. So we've got about 15 minutes left. Before we go to the... Oh, we're at time. Okay, cool. Even better. All righty, so let's pray and call it good.